I'm Commander Shepard, and this is my favorite lorecast on the Citadel.
Welcome to the Mass Effect Lorecast, the podcast where we explore the vast universe of lore behind the Mass Effect games. We'll talk about all the details you may have missed, ask the hard questions, and more. Spectres, welcome back to the Mass Effect Lorecast. This is your host, Tom, or Robots, and I'm here with my good buddy, Sam. And Sam, I am excited about today's episode because we're talking about the technology of weapons, and this sounds freaking awesome.
Yes.
How you doing, man?
Bang, bang.
Bang, bang.
I'm good. And yeah, we're taking a different turn. We were just doing a couple episodes on Edie, but since Edie is, she controls the Normandy cyber warfare suite, and Edie's a person, but Edie's also technology. So,
Right. Yeah. So
I figured this was, since we're doing alternating episodes and topics, I figured it was only appropriate to address one of the community's favorite aspects of the games, the weapons.
The weapons, because, you do spend a significant portion of the game blowing things up.
Oh, yeah. Well, so, I do.
Sometimes I enjoy that stuff. Well, if I were to rank it, it would be blowing stuff up, talking to people, especially the people I want to talk to, not just everybody. Sometimes I'm just like, God, just move on with the conversation, right? But there are definitely people that you're like, oh, this is a character I like, or like, ooh, this is really cool for the lore, And then walking down the hallways, and we all know that I'm not a big fan of
I was going to ask where
hallways and
where
elevators.
On your priority list does banging aliens go?
That's below conversation, because usually I'm pretty bad at making that work out. Because I don't look at the spoilery walkthroughs that are like, if you really want to get in good with so and so, you need to say these things and not do these things, and that crap. Like, I generally just kind of like, this is where my Shepard is right now. Oh, we're not compatible.
That same thing happened with me and Tally on my last broship playthrough. Basically, Tally's loyalty mission, she asks you to lie for her, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Talked about this.
I was like, no, I'm not gonna do that,
right? And then all of a sudden you're like, oh well, that part of the whole game is just cut off for me. It's not gonna happen.
All of a sudden she cancels on dinner. It's this whole big thing.
But then the hallways and then the elevators are at the bottom.
Yes, Mass Effect elevator ride.
Yeah. So anyway, let's get into the things people actually want to talk about, or at least hear about on this episode. The small arms and weapons and stuff. Where do we start?
So they definitely don't use black powder. However, a Mass Effect musket would be something of a meme, and I'd love to see it.
Yeah, right.
Special message to all you modders out there. And I'm glad that we're going to talk about the weapons, because more specifically, we're talking about the technology that drives them, the technology that makes Mass Effect weapons different than those in our own world.
Right. Okay. So kick us off. How much more advanced is the average gun in Mass Effect?
From what I've seen, nearly every basic projectile weapon, with a few notable exceptions, uses mass accelerator technology. And to understand why the weapons are advanced, we should get into what that even means. Mass Effect accelerator technology relies on some of the basic scientific, I'm going to put scientific in quotes here, scientific principle that most advancements in the Mass Effect universe have, which is using an electrical current passing through element zero to generate a Mass Effect field. And that is a field around an object or person that reduces or increases the amount of mass inside that field. So this is the principle behind how ships are able to travel at faster than light speeds. It's also what powers Trainer's toothbrush. So the applications of this principle are like far and wide. Mm-hmm. And in this case of guns, they're using the fields to alter the mass of their bullets, and I put bullets in quotes, to travel at incredibly high speeds with the same force of propulsion. The result is that guns can now fire at such high speeds that were never possible before.
So these are kind of like rail guns, but rail guns in the future. So like a rail gun is projected through magnetic technology. So basically you put a gigantic magnetic force on something and then launch it out, and it it flies faster than it would if you were to put combustion behind it, an explosion, right?
Yes.
This is like reducing the mass of the projectile to a point where when you do accelerate it, it accelerates at extremely fast velocities because it doesn't have any mass. Like there's no drag on it. There's no, the more mass something has, the more energy it takes to move it, it to increase its speed. But if something has very low mass, you can increase the speed exponentially. And now you're having things that just are moving way faster than the speed of sound.
Oh yeah.
And, yeah, and in the case of like traveling from galaxy, you know, across the galaxy, like close to the speed of light.
And that brings up a good point. You know, if it's fast enough, is it going to break the speed of sound and go even, and like, if it's even faster, does that mean it's even louder? But I would argue for Mass Effect guns, that doesn't really apply because they're not, again, it's not combustion. So you're still going to hear a sound, but it's likely going to be the result of an electromagnetic propulsion.
Yeah, I wonder if, because it reduces in mass, I wonder if the actual projectiles are very small. Because a very small, low-mass thing moving at a very fast speed still creates a lot of destruction when it comes into contact with something else. So this is, for example, the fear of getting hit by meteors on the planet, right? Like, if the meteor is only the size of, like, a city block, that's really not very big compared to the size of the Earth. But if the thing is hurtling towards Earth at, like, I don't know, gigantic numbers, you know, millions of miles per hour, then all of the kinetic energy that's built up in that speed of the object is the part that's dangerous. It's not the size so much. So yes. I would imagine with a mass propelled through a gun like this, it's really about the amount of speed and not about the amount of mass that really does the damage. So a very, very small projectile landing on somebody at that high velocity could still basically do a ton of damage.
And you'd be right, because that is how the lore paints it for us in the Codex and in all the explanations. They specifically say that, you know, the projectiles are really not that large. And the Codex itself gives us this wonderful image of what this can mean in the extreme case. You know, just like you were saying, the Codex says, if accelerated to a high enough velocity, a simple paint chip can impact with the same destructive force as a nuclear weapon. However, mass accelerators produce recoil equal to their impact energy.
So you're going to get blown backwards at the same rate that the thing would be coming out of the front of the weapon.
Right, so there's a limit. Basically, they wrote in a way for them not to get, like overpowered in the game by themselves, you know.
Right.
And, you know, considering that the average small arms fire, it just shears off tiny slices of that metal block. Like, there's no magazine in Mass Effect weapons. Mm-hmm. It's not like our weapons where you load a magazine with bullets. It's just a block of metal that they put in there. And the computer, it like shaves off, like it calculates how much it needs, and it shaves off a very thin slice, like a slug, mm-hmm. of that metal. So,
and we're talking like millimeters, like itty bitty.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so considering that the average small arms fire just shears that off, imagine how deadly the 150 millimeter mass accelerator cannon on the Mako is. Mm-hmm. It starts to make sense why when you fire that thing at Geth, they just disintegrate.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, that's crazy.
But again, this doesn't mean that the physical equation can be wildly unbalanced, right? You can tell the writers really thought this through because they note in the Codex that weapon recoil is basically still the huge X factor. To fire something at speeds fast enough to create a nuclear explosion, you would need a lot of force, even with mass reducing fields. And my personal guess is that there's just not enough ezo in a weapon to do that. Like the rifle can only be so big. It can only hold so much ezo to produce the, you know, mass reduction field needed to, like, if you don't have the propulsion, if you don't have the, not in this case combustion, but electromagnetic propulsion, if that's not high enough to fire, let's say, a baseball at speeds necessary for a nuclear explosion, uh-huh. then you would need to reduce the mass of that baseball enough.
Right.
Exponentially more. And you can't do that with these weapons because, as I imagine, there's just simply not enough ezo, not enough electric current running through them to reduce the mass enough. So there is a limit.
Right. Whereas, like on a spaceship, you could have a gigantic amount of ezo and a lot of current from the generator on the spaceship. And so, therefore, you could take something that was the size of a baseball and reduce it to a very, very small mass and then shoot it out at a very fast speed and create a gigantic explosion.
Oh, yeah. And you know, but most small arms in Mass Effect, they do use that electromagnetic attraction and repulsion to physically propel the projectiles. Mm-hmm. And so you may be wondering at this point, what exactly they fire? Well, like I said, it's not bullets. Here's what the Codex tells us. Quote, the ammo magazine is a simple block of metal. The gun's internal computer calculates the mass needed to reach the target based on the distance, gravity, and atmospheric pressure, and then shears off an appropriately sized slug from the block. A single block can supply thousands of rounds, making ammunition a non-issue during any engagement.
So it's adjusting the size of the projectile for every single shot.
Yeah. That's how intelligent it is.
That's crazy. Further away shots are probably smaller projectiles because they need to travel further, so they need less drag on them and yada, yada, yada. Whereas a closer shot might require a larger piece because it doesn't need to accelerate as much.
I was just thinking, what if it was a farther away shot? Would it need a larger slug because of the inertia?
Maybe. Yeah. I guess that's where the computer comes in. Is it
right?
Like it balances that out. Like on this planet, there's this much air drag on the projectile. There's this much inertia. There's this much gravity. So there's going to be a certain amount of drop of the projectile over time. Yeah. Right.
So and it's different worlds too.
Right. Yeah. So on this planet, it's going to work like this. On the moon, it's going to work like this. Yeah, that's cool. It makes sense, though, because then the computer's doing the heavy lifting. You, as the person shooting the gun, simply need to line the thing up in your sights and pull the trigger.
Right.
It's
right.
Figuring
Soldier.
Out yeah, what it needs
Soldier's
to do
like,
in order to get there.
Gun go burr.
Right, right. That's it. That's it. You just gotta aim and pull the trigger, and the computer's going to make sure that the projectile can get to your destination and do the most amount of damage at the same time.
Exactly. But, you know, unlike conventional bullets, those slugs are not meant to just pierce an object. They're designed to flatten or shatter on impact for maximum damage. And this reminds me a lot of hollow point rounds or other custom rounds in weapons that are, to my knowledge, banned by the Geneva Conventions.
Yeah, but some places you can still get them. So this means that like every gun has a computer inside it, right?
It does. And while that by itself is not that different from where firearms technology is headed now, you have to understand that how intelligent these computers are. Like, I think we're beating a dead horse a little bit, but in the time it takes a gunner to raise the weapon, aim, and fire, the computer is calculating how much of that metal block to shear off to propel at what speeds, given the distance of the target, for the desired damage. And on top of that, the lore tells us that it also compensates for gravity and atmospheric pressure on different worlds. Mm-hmm. So it's making all of these observations and calculations and all of these things literally in the time it takes to fire the weapon.
So I wonder if... Are the guns equipped with devices that can detect the environment around them, or are they getting remote information from, say, the ship's computer or something like that before your crew even makes it to the ground? And I don't know that this is spelled out in the lore, but...
It's not. However, it might be, because there are weapons that the Andromeda Initiative takes with them. I think the X5 Ghost can function as a black box recording for explorers because you can literally store your like audio logs in there. And if you needed to leave it behind for a black box recording, like someone coming by later could pick up that weapon and understand what happened to you.
Right. So the weapons computer is basically like a smartphone just on the weapon.
And right. It and it do does many link different with the things. Omni tool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah. I just wonder, though, is like, does each gun individually test the atmosphere around it? Like, does it have like a sensor on the gun that's like, oh, this is the density and the composition of the atmosphere, or like, a gravity meter that can detect it? Or is it generally common enough. Like anywhere you go on a planet is going to be within a certain range, a certain acceptable mathematical range of variance. If it's like the guns just sync up with the computer on the Normandy or whatever, right? And then you drop down to the planet and the guns know, like, oh, this is the nearest body that we're on, like this is the nearest place sure. for us to be going. It just grabs that information from, you know, the main computer.
Well, in Mass Effect 1, I think it would be a lore friendly explanation. It's we're definitely, you know, speculating here,
yeah,
but
yeah, we're out on a limb.
Explanation: if we said the Alliance calibrated those settings before they sent soldiers down planet side for a mission. Mm-hmm. But in Mass Effect 2 and 3, I mean, ED could do it for you remotely.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I think with ED it would be a non-issue. And you know, some weapons have even better targeting software. The top of the line weapons, the Codex tells us, can fire on a target in a howling gale, and it still feels the same as it does on a calm day on a practice range.
That's crazy. I wonder how that works. Like, you know, because if you're shooting at something at a distance, you have to point in a slate. Like, does the nozzle of the gun bend? In order to compensate?
I would imagine it shoots it faster, shoots it harder.
I see. So that there's less time for the wind to even impact it. It's like mm-hmm. even smaller projectile moving at a faster rate means that there's less time for the influence of the environment.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. This is really, really cool stuff. But you know what? We've got a mid break. We've got to thank our patrons and we've got to talk about the patron chat, which is coming up next week. So let's go do that. Then we're going to come back and we're talk more about these awesome weapons.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Message coming in. Patching it through.
I am sovereign, and this station is mine. I like the sound of that.
All right, here we are, patrons. This is your time to shine. We get to thank our newest patrons, who include... I'm gonna mess up. Words are hard. Words are hard. All right. Here we go. I'm just gonna take a swing at this one. Thaliaris, I think. Thank you for signing up and joining us, Thaliaris, and Commander Frosty, and we have one of our patrons, Jillian B, who upgraded this last month. So thank you to all three of you guys. Welcome to the Patreon, new patrons, and thank you to all 63 of our current patrons. We're getting closer and closer, Sam, to that magical 69 number.
Yeah, I don't know. Are we going to get to 69 before my birthday?
Seems like a personal question.
In my personal life, the forecast says, shaking a magic eight ball. No.
Okay. Unlikely. Oh. But thank you to all of our 63 of our patrons, including our Shepherd tier patrons who get shout outs every week. This includes Kolkashins, Cloudy Atlas, Kira, Lieutenant Tosino, Pipe Man, and Big Bills 63. Thank you to everybody who supports the show. Also, if you are a tier 4 or higher member, or if you would like to sign up in the next week, you can join us next week for our end of the month patron chat. We need to decide on a topic. I don't think we've decided on one yet, but you're also welcome to offer up topic ideas too. So all of that happens on the Discord. You've got a week. The patron chat will be next Monday, which is today's the 18th as we record it. That's the 25th at 10:30 Eastern, 7:30 Pacific. So if you'd like to join us, that's how you can do it. And if you're interested in just checking out all the different tiers and all the stuff that you can get, patreon.com/Mass Effect Lorecast is the place to do it. Also, you know, we don't have any new reviews this week, but if you'd like to leave us a review and a rating, we love it. Apple Podcasts, you can do that. We'll read it out on a future episode. Spotify is a great place to drop a rating as well. All of that stuff helps. And last thing I'm going to shout out before we get back to the middle of the back from the middle of the show, our YouTube channel, the Mass Effect Lorecast YouTube channel, is getting closer and closer to that 1,000 subs. I think we're about to eclipse 700. So if you'd like to drop us a follow on there, or a sub, I think it's called subs, right? It's YouTube, so they're called subscribers. Then that would be super helpful. We'd really appreciate it. Plus, you get to see our beautiful faces. So go check that out. All right, that's it for the mid-break this week. Let's get on with the rest of the show.
Spit it out, or are you trying to build suspense?
You're so dense, sir. Obviously, I do not know as much about human relationships as I thought.
Okay, so we're talking about weapons, we're talking about small arms, we're talking about shooting things, we're talking about the projectiles being these little pieces of metal that are kind of chipped off a block, right? So if that's the case, how do special ammo types work?
And, you know, I was curious about this too. So I tried to get a definitive answer in the lore, and here's what I found. Quote, "The development of practical manufacturing omni-tools allows modern militaries a great deal of flexibility in equipment loadouts." So right away, we're basically told, long story short, because omni-tool.
Okay.
And so I was like, you know, I read that at first and I wasn't necessarily satisfied. It felt like a little bit of a cop-out. Mm. But then I kept reading in the secondary codex entries section, and it says, quote, "An upgrade kit typically consists of less than a dozen unique parts and an optical storage disk. When loaded into an Omni-tool, the OSD provides all technical specifications required to manufacture the tool and additional parts necessary to install the upgrade onto another piece of equipment. Assembly is typically modular, and an installation can be completed in less than a minute." So it doesn't necessarily say, like, you know, special ammo types are used this way. But if we consider them equipment, which I'm pretty sure that they are considered equipment, mm-hmm. It makes sense to me.
Hmm. So it's like the Omni tool is giving us a piece that is added to the gun that then here's my question about this. Is it an addition to the gun that alters the nature of the ammo block? Or is it a different type of ammo that's created by the Omni tool that's taking the place of the currently existing ammo block?
Now, I'm speculating here, but my guess would be it doesn't have to do with the ammo block at all. Because if you listen to that, when loaded into an Omni tool, the storage disk provides the technical specifications required to manufacture the tool. So what I'm thinking is, you get that OSD, you put it in your Omni tool, it syncs with your weapon. And then one of two things could happen. Maybe the weapon is already able to alter the ammo type, and that when you put the OSD in, it just like unlocks the capability for the weapon to do it.
It's like turning it on.
It's like a software.
Right.
But the other part that I thought maybe was plausible was, what if it's not altering the ammo block at all? What if it's altering the Mass Effect field?
Hmm. So that the nature of the Mass Effect field causes a different effect?
Right. Maybe you could alter the Mass Effect field generating capabilities so that anything inside the field is maybe hyper frozen, cold down. That's how you get your cryo ammo.
Right.
I don't know.
Right.
Maybe through different, you know, reducing or increasing of mass and other physical qualities, that it could heat it up inside.
Yeah, it takes more drag through the atmosphere. So therefore, it's not actually heating it in the gun. It's heating it on the way to the target.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Huh.
And so at least this is what I saw for small arms. And if we take a step back, I think this is a pretty fourth wall breaking explanation, because if you think about it, that is exactly how the game devs program your weapon to say switch to Inferno ammo. They literally wrote a line of code
right.
that gets triggered when the player turns it on. And so if we're right in inferring this entry from the codex, that is how Shepard turns on the code from their Omni tool. And then all of a sudden now they have this new kind of ammo. We are telling the game to tell Shepard to turn it on.
right.
So it feels a little bit like, you know, the guy sitting at his PC playing a game, and then like you look at the screen of the PC and it's the guy playing the game.
Right. Yeah. It's all just like mirroring everything else. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Hmm. And it's also, I think the same would go for tech armor, because your Omni tool can manufacture these things, right? Mm-hmm. It just needs the right resources. It needs plastic, ceramics, or the technical specifications that are dictated by the optical storage disk, you know. So,
right.
Interestingly, a secondary codex entry also tells us that soldiers should be able to fabricate upgrade kits from virtually nothing. Here's what it says. Since Omni tools are designed to use common battlefield materials, salvage materials, such as plastic, ceramics, and light materials, rendered into semi-molten Omni gel for quick use, it is quite possible for a trained soldier carrying upgrade kits to customize gear on the battlefield to fit the current tactical situation.
Yeah, it's still vague, but
it's vague.
It leaves a lot of opportunity for like, well, this could be updating your ammo or updating, you know, this piece of armor.
Right.
Yeah.
You just need the plastic, ceramics, light materials, you know, you name it. So
right. You just MacGyver it from whatever situation you're in. You're like,
it sounds like
I found myself in a blown up kitchen. I'm just going to grab all the dishes over here and turn them into Omnigel. And now I've got upgraded armor.
Right. And so like that's exactly what it sounds like, that as long as you have those basic components, the Omni tool is like, oh, I can work with this.
right.
Let me just MacGyver something real quick. Yeah. So, you know, but that being said, can you remember any Mass Effect game where you just looked for resources and then could create the upgrades themselves, and as opposed to finding the upgrade items?
Yeah, no. I mean, there's Omnigel, but it doesn't exactly do that.
So maybe we should have been able to create, you know, quote unquote, create upgrade kits from given amounts of those resources that we've recovered through the game.
Do you think maybe there was like a crafting system that was originally considered? Yeah. And then they're just like, we don't have time to implement it.
Maybe that was a previous idea that they had before just letting us find and pick up items starting in Mass Effect 1. Yeah. And that's kind of exactly what I thought when I read that. This explanation in the writing would have made a lot of sense for an original game mechanic that may have been taken out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or maybe, you know, in universe, we are actually picking up the resources when we loot that crate, when we, you know, break into this safe. We're actually just picking up the resources, and the Omni tool in real time is telling us which items can be created from these.
Right. So we're not actually seeing the mechanics. We're just seeing the end result.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So given how these small arms function, it sounds like whoever had more ammo and could fire faster could just overwhelm shields and win.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because this is also the lore's reason why we switch from Mass Effect 1's system of heat sinks to the normalization of thermal clips in Mass Effect 2 and 3. So while ammo was a non-issue, like the Codex says in Mass Effect 1, that meant that it wasn't really about who had more ammo, but being able to lay down heavy fire more continuously for a longer time meant you could overwhelm enemies' shields quicker.
So why not just more durable heat sinks instead of thermal clips?
That answer comes from the Geth. During the Geth War through Mass Effect 1, they performed mathematical analysis on their combat logs, and what they found was the same conclusion you had mentioned. More sustained fire without having to pause to vent your weapon or fire slower to manage that heat meant that you could win. You could win engagements.
You break shields. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if you can break your enemy's shields before you know, your shields get broken, then they're dead. Easy.
Yeah.
So the Geth made disposable heat sinks, aka thermal clips, because soldiers wouldn't need to pause or slow down to manage the heat. And following the Geth attack on the Citadel, now this part I'm guessing the timeline wise, but this is what happened. I'm guessing enough Geth had died from around the other races in Citadel space that their leftover technology was reverse engineered, because the lore tells us that in the 2 years after Shepard died, the entire arms industry underwent this massive shift. The manufacturers eventually adopted thermal clips as standard, with a soldier being able to eject and swap the clips in under a second. And when I read that in the lore, my first thought was, well, of course the arms manufacturers are going to adopt this. It sounds a lot more lucrative, doesn't it?
Right. Well, replaceable parts, you're going to pay more for them. But it also makes sense that you don't have to wait for something to cool down. You just eject the hot one, put a cool one in, and keep going. So,
yeah. You probably couldn't afford to slow down the pace of combat in unforeseen circumstances.
Right.
Like, oh, I just got flanked, but I'm waiting for my weapon to like cool down.
Right. Yeah. No, I just pop a new clip in and I'm ready to go. Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah. Makes sense. So, okay. So I know the answer is probably a lot more arbitrary, but what do we know about how they came up with the designs for the weapons?
Well, we know a lot less, in short. And first of all, before we move on, I do want to say that the reason with thermal clips and heat sinks that we just talked about, that's the reason that we're given in the lore. That's, of course, like in real life, the answer is a lot different. It's that it sped up gameplay and it made more fun.
Yeah.
That's the answer. But in terms of the lore, that's what it tells us. But about the design of the weapons, we do know a few things. Of course, there is the standard classes of weapons like assault rifles, snipers, shotguns, pistols, and then later submachine guns and heavy pistols. But guns in Mass Effect are collapsible, which is pretty cool because it means you can store more weapons on your back. But it also makes me wonder what they're made of for weight purposes, right?
Yeah.
Because if you have a gun made of lead,
right, it's going to be very
collapsible.
Heavy and, right. That's yeah.
Yeah. And then I guess I haven't looked into this yet, but if the gun is heavy enough, I wonder if your armor has specific Mass Effect fields that go around the weapon to reduce it so that your soldier is not like,
oh, God, I have three guns on me. It's so heavy. Yeah. Well, chances are, like in the real world, it's going to be a combination of very resilient and dense material that's as light as we can possibly make it with the most recent technology we have.
Right. Polymers, alloys,
yeah.
Words.
Words.
And you may also notice that most of the original weapons in Mass Effect have this arch design. It's an arch design. Look on the piece that's right next to the shoulder mount. Mm-hmm. And I noticed this because I have this book, The Art of Mass Effect. And there are all these different concept art and all this stuff. And I noticed a similar trend because it pointed it out, the art team did in their book, that all of these weapons have a very similar arch design. Like it's just like a,
yeah,
like a shallow arch.
Kind of a, yeah.
Yeah.
Concave shape to it.
And where else do we see this? Well, we see this in the Mass Effect logo itself.
Convex? Did I mess that up? Oh, you're right. Yeah. Yeah.
The crest of the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what it's supposed to be. And so it's also present in so many other ships and architecture and more in the games that when I noticed it in the weapons, I was like, I've been playing this game for 15 years. How have I not noticed this before? But yeah, it's pretty cool that they incorporated that design there starting in Mass Effect 1. And then from the beginning, the art team decided not to give, or I'm sorry, they decided to give most weapons two barrels, not for functionality, but just for a futuristic, this is different aesthetic touch.
Really? That's why?
Yeah. Yeah, so most weapons don't use their two barrels, but if you look, most weapons do have two barrels. And this design choice continued into Mass Effect 2, despite that the art team says that they made a concerted effort to make their weapons in Mass Effect 2 look less futuristic. They didn't want them to look as futuristic in Mass Effect 2. Why? They wanted to broaden the appeal.
Right, more relatable by people as like, oh, this looks like a gun, rather than just this looks like a space shape.
Right, right. And they wanted, and I think that confirms what a lot of hardcore Mass Effect fans already thought. One was hardcore sci-fi, and then they toned it down a little bit to appeal to the masses, because they're like, okay, you sci-fi weirdos, we need to bring the normies in for more money.
Right. Yeah, of course. Of course. So wait, so does this just go for human weapons or every race?
Well, by Mass Effect 2, the art team said that they had made Citadel species weaponry look similar because they wanted to convey that most species were getting weapons from the same suppliers. Mm-hmm. Everyone except for the collectors and the Geth. I wonder if that was because they wanted to or because they didn't have the time to produce different looking weapons for every race.
Yeah, that's
that
multiplies the art demand.
Yes, and I cannot imagine what their timeline was like after EA bought BioWare.
Yeah, we do. There's definitely a sense that like 2 and 3 definitely were limited on when they needed to be out for release and all of that. So,
right.
Yeah.
Or maybe the art team is being completely transparent and that they genuinely just wanted it to look the same to convey multi-race corporations. The art team did make a distinct departure from that, though. In Mass Effect 3, because they tailored each race's weaponry after design themes already apparent in that race's ships, mm-hmm. architecture, and armor. A key example of this is as soon as you land on Zerkesh in Mass Effect 3, you meet up with Paddock Weeks, who, fun fact, named after one of the writers, Patrick Weeks. and he fires a Salarian pistol when Cerberus invades, and the Salarian pistol looks incredibly different. We've never seen a pistol like this to this point in Mass Effect at all. And the art team commented on this pistol in that book, and they said that they took the elements visible in the pistol, which are rounded edges and very circular elements. They're not hard angles.
Yeah.
And they said that they took those elements from Morden's armor.
Makes sense. It's not uncommon. Take themes and kind of use the themes through, like, in fantasy, it would be like, this race has these themes in their architecture, but that also shows up in their armor designs and their weapons. Like, this is the space equivalent of that.
Oh, yeah. And you can tell with, in Mass Effect 3, you can tell that that is the case with a lot of Turian equipment and Quarian equipment as well. Mm-hmm. A lot of electricity kind of themed things involved with the Quarians make sense because who have they been fighting for a long time? Well, they had, you know, their main enemy was the Geth.
Right.
So you'd want to engineer your weapons to be primarily electric. And the same went for Mass Effect Andromeda with Milky Way originating weapons having distinct differences in appearance than those from the Helios cluster in Andromeda or the gear from the Remnant. So very, very cool choice. I'm glad that they allowed more bandwidth for the art team to keep that level of consistency. And by, of course, Mass Effect 3 and Mass Effect Andromeda's time, weapons appearances changed as you upgraded them. So depending on which attachments you put on there, things would look different.
Right, right. Well, this has been very, very cool. I know we've got some other things to discuss next time. Where are we going in the next episode?
So we went over the technology and the design of typical small arms in the Milky Way. But next time, we're going to talk about some notable exceptions and unique weapons and how they work.
Very, very cool. Very, very cool. Well, guys, this is the we're going to wrap up the episode here. Thank you for joining us. Sam, you have anything you want to shout out? Anything cool stuff going on?
Well, I'm incredibly busy right now with a couple of things in my personal life, but I am still streaming every week Sassy Ship Saturday for Mass Effect, and it is modded Mass Effect. And I'm also streaming on Thursdays Dragon Age. I finally finished the Fade for the first time. Mm. That is a huge relief. And so I'm happy to get on with the rest of the game now. but those are Thedas Thursdays. And I'm streaming occasionally on Mondays before we air this show live on Twitch. But it kind of just depends on how much time I have after I'm done with the notes. And do I need time to eat dinner and yada, yada, yada.
Sure.
But anyway, you can get all those streams at Twitch. You can follow me at N7 The Legend.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, I've been streaming more lately, too. I've been playing lots of different things. I've been trying out different mods, like the Skyrim Together co-op mod. And you and I played Elden Ring co-op the other night. We're going to do more of that whenever you get a little bit more free time. And if you want to join me for any of my live streams, then come join over on the Robots Radio channels. There's Robots Radio YouTube. There's Twitch. There's Facebook. I restream to all those locations. So you just pick the one you like the best and you can watch over there. So that's what I got going on. We are going to head out, but if you're here for the live stream, don't go anywhere, because we're going to move right into another episode, double recording Mondays. So stay here for that. And until next time, stay safe out there, everybody. We'll see you later.
Thanks for tuning in to the Mass Effect Lorecast. We'd love to hear your opinion and thoughts on the lore of Mass Effect. Reach out to us on Twitter at Mass Effect Cast, or check out the Robots Radio Discord. Also, you can send us an email at masseffectlorecast@gmail.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.